today on the Bird Gang Powerlifting Podcast.
Steve DeNovi, aka PRs Performance, is joining us to talk about the most important part of the lift, how to become the best powerlifter long term, and much, much more.
The Elite is our English series where we interview world-level coaches and lifters.
Das ist schon geil. Das ist einfach so unglaublich, unglaublich spannend.
Aber es ist schon geil.
Einfach erzählen.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Bird Gang Powerlifting Podcast. My name is Maximilian Rabe. I'm here with Kona Novak. Sadly, Falk couldn't join us today, so I have the honor to introduce our guest. He's one of the founders of Powerlifting Now, one of the biggest educational platforms on all things powerlifting. He was a longtime coach of Sean Noriega, now coaches people like Natalie Richards and Sheffield competitor Waska Carpio. Welcome, Steve DeNovi.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. I was disappointed the music cut out so quick. I was about to start moshing. It was hard. That was going hard.
Yeah, we will definitely release a full-time version in the future.
Oh, there we go. Perfect. So, but yeah, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. I mentioned you guys when you reached out. I'll hopefully make my way over to Germany this year as well. My wife actually went last year without me to go see a Taylor Swift concert, actually. My turn to head over myself.
And so it was only available in Germany.
It was cheaper. It was literally cheaper to fly to Germany and go see Taylor Swift because of the laws you have with price gouging ticket resales.
I heard about that. Yeah, I heard about that.
It's ridiculous in the US. So it was literally cheaper to fly over to Germany.
I don't know if the world championship in powerlifting can compare to a Taylor Swift concert.
Yeah, but I don't know.
We will see.
I'm just going to bank that one in the husband bank because I'll pull out a golf trip to Scotland at some point and I'll get a yes.
Perfect, perfect.
All right. So we recently had Pavel Jurczynski in our podcast and we've talked about his influences and everything. And he said you are one of his three biggest heroes of powerlifting. That's why this call up here is such a nice follow-up. Of course, you are a very big influence for us as well. I mean, Maxi already said Powerlifting Now is such a big platform for educational content. That's actually, at least for us coaches, quite a big influence because there's so many quite compact ideas, things about programming and coaching. So as a small ad, of course, for Powerlifting Now, who's not subscribed yet, you shall definitely do it. Talking about powerlifting now, what got you into creating the content in the first place? Because you've been making tons of videos already on YouTube way before Powerlifting Now launched. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like there was a gap in information out there? Or was it more about putting your own spin on things?
Yeah. So I'll backtrack a little bit because there's multiple reasons here of why I got into it. Are you familiar with Elite FTS?
Yeah.
Okay. I actually, way back before YouTube, I like 6 years before YouTube even started, maybe it was like 2016 or 17, I was writing some articles for Elite FTS and doing blog posts. And there was a couple reasons I was doing that. One, I just like writing and doing content. Like it's a way for me to put my thoughts down. And content as a whole, it's a great way to learn. And I'll explain that here in a little bit. But within that, one of the reasons I really put a lot of emphasis in doing that in the first place was because when I first started out, especially in the area I'm in, is a big untested federation area. There was very few tested powerlifting meets. So it was about the big old roided up guys. And I'm this skinny little dude who doesn't even really look like he powerlifts. I really don't now. But even then, when I was lifting, it was 190, 200. It was still questionable. I knew I had to rely on something different. I wasn't strong. I didn't have any notable athletes. I didn't have some big following. So I was like, comparatively, I need to create the perception of intelligence. And I say perception because that's what draws people in, is like maybe it's because that's how people trick people. But you might not be intelligent, but if you speak really fluently and like you sound really smart, you can get people to think you're smarter than you are. So, I mean, hopefully people find me intelligent, but that was kind of my niche of what I thought I needed to do. It's like, okay, I can't be stronger. I don't have a following. So what no one else is doing in my local area, I was really just thinking my local area, is putting out information that's really intelligent and like forward thinking and really trying to dive deeper into things. So I was like, that's what I'm going to kind of go on, is I'm going to be the more like semi science based, higher education, knowledgeable powerlifting coach. And that worked great. I did a lot of blog posts. I did a lot of stuff like that. And that was about the time I realized blogging was dying. This is probably 2016, 17, 18. It was the cool thing for a long time. And I started realizing no one's reading blog posts anymore, as well as the fact that all of powerlifting is centralizing to Instagram, because it's a perfect medium for a sport that only lasts 10 seconds per lift. I mean, that's why it fits so well there. And I did this super weird thing where I started writing blog posts in Instagram captions. And I was like, I'm just going to do it and see what happens. And it worked great. There's a special group of people who want to read that type of stuff. It's not everyone, but those are the type of people I was targeting, of like people who wanted a very deep understanding. And just kind of one thing led to another, and that continued to build. I continued to gain momentum within coaching and whatnot, more so locally. And it was really just based around this idea of like creating content and putting out this perception of being a bit more knowledgeable and having putting a lot of thought into what I was doing technique wise and programming wise. And then YouTube came about. I was planning on doing YouTube for a while. I was super scared. Fun fact, I think twice I went to a gym to record and twice I left without recording because I was too nervous to do it. Yeah.
So you just didn't record, or you recorded stuff and just thought, nah, it's not going to make it into the edit?
Yeah, I recorded like two or three sentences and I just felt so weird and I felt so uncomfortable. And I was like, I can't do this. I think anyone who's done something like that has had that feeling at first. Like it's not a comfortable feeling. So like when you look at like myself or anyone who else who is more of a well-known content creator in powerlifting, we probably all started at the same spot where it felt very, very uncomfortable to do it. But finally COVID rolled around and I was like, all right, I'm so bored. I have no one to talk to. So I'm just going to talk to this camera. And that worked a lot. That worked out well. So then I started the YouTube channel that eventually blew up. And then that eventually led to powerlifting now. But, primary reason to start making the content was in large part a marketing tactic. It was like, okay, I've got to be able to like differentiate myself from other coaches. I need to put out this content. And I specifically went this very long form route because the short form is saturated and still to this day is saturated. Yeah. It's way easier to make a 30 to 60 second video or one little slide that's super, like it's way easier to do that. And I was like, okay, is the market shorter for this long form content types or smaller? Like there's not as many people, but those type of people are actually more loyal because they're the ones that are willing to invest more in their education. They're the ones that are willing to put more into this and more time and effort. They're actually people who are worth more as a customer per se. They're not this is like, I want a quick fix. They're something like, I want the deep and tangible information and really dive deep into this. And so specifically on the YouTube stuff, that's where I was like, okay, There's all these great YouTube channels. If I make these 5 to 10 minute videos, I'm just competing with all of them too. But if I make these 20, 30, 40, 50 minute videos, I don't know of anyone else doing this. Who else is showing the entirety of their programming, like without any hiding, like who's showing everything they're doing? I was like, let's do it. And it worked again. Like I don't have 100,000 subscribers, but the 15 to 16,000 subscribers I have are the ones who would be willing to pay for a Powerlifting Now subscription because they really highly value the education and that type of content and are really willing to learn versus the people who generally watch those 100,000 subscriber 5 minute videos. Those are lifters wanting to watch 2 minutes of a video, get a quick tip on how to squat, and then they're done. And then they probably don't think about that person anymore because they just wanted to watch that one video they saw real quick. So, and then within that too, I like doing it. I think I've always felt like I have a bit of a passion or at least a skill set for education. I think I have the ability to be able to take what's in my head and convey that to people decently well. Not only like through language and just explaining it, but like being able to organize it. 'Cause that's the hardest part with content. Anyone can talk for 60 minutes, but to be able to actually make a 60 minute video that flows correctly and is organized to help kind of keep the listener or viewer's retention throughout the entire thing, it is an art in itself. It's actually a video I might make on Powerlifting Now at some point, is like how to make long form content. But I enjoy it. And then I learned so much from it. We actually just did our first Q&A live stream for Powerlifting Now. And one of the questions on there was, what's the main ways you find yourself learning? And one of the number one ways I learn is through making content, because if I'm going to put something out that people actually are going to watch and are going to get benefit from, I've got to be an expert on it.
So when you made the, I vividly remember the 1 hour bench full tutorial, did you have so much stuff already in mind that you want to get down to one video, or did you actually have the idea and then research for it?
That one, I think I already had the information I needed. Like I that was just kind of spitting out. If I had someone sitting right next to me and I was going to teach them how to bench press, this is what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much what that video was, is just going step by step of each step of the process of bench pressing. And let's go through it. So that one honestly was a bit easier, where I've had a lot of other videos where I sit down and go to start writing an outline. I'm like, I don't know enough about this topic. I thought I did, but I'm knowledgeable, but I'm not an expert. I can't teach other people how to do this yet. Mm. I can only know how to do it myself. And that's the difference between education and just general knowledge, is a lot of people understand what to do, but there's the next step and be able to take that and know how to teach someone else who doesn't know how to do that in a way they can understand. And so I have so many topics that I've gone down and I sit down, I'm like, oh, this is my knowledge gap. I know this, but I'm not an expert. I need to learn more. I have some topics that 3 months later I'll come back to and I feel like I've got the information I need. I have some others that take 2 years.
The best analogy for this is basically just cues that work for yourself. Like everyone has some cues that are just straight up perfect for your lifting style and whatever. And when you tell others, they're like, what am I supposed to do with that?
Yep.
And transforming these cues into cues that work for others as well is so hard. It's complicated to even tell them your information and then have it so compact into one cue. It's just rough.
I mean, I can't tell you how many video ideas or cues or thoughts I've had that I'll actually message the little group chat for Power Off Now with Marcella, Sean, and Matt. Like, okay, is this dumb or is this good? They're like, no, don't do that one. That's not going to work. Because there's a lot of things that we might do or anyone might do that it works for you, but you realize that this isn't something that's going to have broad appeal and work for everyone. Like that, there's an art to this content and education aspect of like, you've got to understand like what would be beneficial for others and how to be able to say that and teach people with that. So.
I think what I also really like is your ability to widen the spectrum and get a systematical approach. I mean, I remembered when I was talking to the guys about a different idea of a split. When do you do deadlifts? The main session before the squat or the other way around? And they are like, oh, I'm not sure. And then I thought, oh, Steve uploaded a video on powerlifting now this month and was like, let's go over every split I can think of and see what could be the best approach for whom and why. And same with your video about the different approaches of programming backoffs. It's not like some coaches which have their system and I have this way and it's the only way. You've gone through every possibility and thought what would make the most sense for which case. And I really, really enjoy that you can have a systematic grip on stuff and not just one single idea which you think is the best.
Well, thank you. I mean, one thing with that is that's the annoying part when I make these videos, is I'll write them and then I'll think of like 18 more things I need to add to it, because that's what I literally want to, like when I make this video, I don't want to ever make it again. That's why I write these extensive outlines, because I want to literally think of every little thing I want to put in this, because I just want it to be complete or else it's going to drive me crazy. It's probably, you would watch it and be like, oh, it's still good. To me, it would drive me crazy. Like, oh, there's like three other things that I think would really be in here. But yeah, as well as I think you kind of alluded to this to an extent, I would talk about like the microcycle stuff, like that video there, that was definitely one of those ones that was like, when I started 10 years ago, I would have loved this. And so a lot of the stuff I make is like, what would have I have really liked when I first started out that would have saved me so much time? And that's really what I'm trying to do, is like, let's do the things that would have really like expedited my learning, and like, let's put this out there so people can be smarter than me eventually, not have to spend 10 years learning this and learn this in a year from all the content and then get way better.
Just as a fun fact, a couple of days ago, I went back, scrolled through all your 663 Instagram posts into the 21st of February, 2018. That's when you posted a blog on squattodeath.com.
Yep.
And it was about why you should squat to parallel.
Mm-hmm. Two things. One, like I said, I used to write for a lot of different places. I used to write for powerliftingtechnique.com, Elite FTS. I like writing, and I think I do a decent job with writing, because when I write, I literally just speak it onto the computer, and that's how I kind of get it, convey it. And I think that's how it kind of comes across, is it sounds like my voice in my writing. With that too, if you ever want to find things faster, every single Instagram post I've ever made, I has made as a blog on my website.
We're going to link this into the show notes, of course, for everyone.
Yeah. If you go to PRsPlatform.com, the past blog post, I have every single Instagram thing I ever made. And then I just would make it a blog post on my website. That kind of kill two birds with one stone, because the website, one, it's a database. It's a little bit easier to search than scrolling on Instagram. But actually, it's a lot of it is for Google search engine optimization, and like having so many different topics that if you search that are going to pop up. So, and then obviously direct towards my website.
And how was the content received? I mean, when you mentioned Elite FDS, I just remembered Dave Tate's video where he tried to teach somebody to deadlift. And it's like always with touching, you have to touch somebody and push his hips forwards physically. And I think at this time, your content was quite the opposite or revolutionary, I would say. How was your content received?
On Elite FTS, it was fine. I mean, I actually stopped writing for them because they had such a long turnaround time. Like it would sometimes be 6, 7, 8 months before they post the article. And I eventually got to the point I was like, I would get more out of this just posting it myself. Because oddly enough, I thought posting on Elite FTS would be this like big thing. No, it got nothing. I got no traction from Elite FTS. But I never really got any kickback from it because I don't think they linked a picture of my 16-inch arms to troll on. So they had no idea.
I listened to you on one podcast. I can't remember if it was Adam Pilo or something like that, where you said that you stopped queuing technical details and focused much more on getting the setup right and let everything else play out from there. Are you still on that route? And when do you step in and intervene with the technique? Or when do you just accept that the technique looks a little bit different from how you would imagine it?
So with the setup, yes, I 100% still do that. That doesn't mean I won't cue other things. It's just that, to kind of backtrack again and explain it, I went down a kind of a rabbit hole in 2020 of biomechanics, which a lot of people did. That was kind of like the cool thing in 2020 was the PRI biomechanics stuff. And we kind of all went down that rabbit hole. And I learned a lot, but it actually really didn't help my coaching because like I couldn't convey those thoughts well to the athletes without confusing them.
What time was this again?
2020.
Because I think everything in Germany happens 2 years later or
yep.
something like this.
Yeah,
yep, definitely.
Australia, Europe, it's always 2 to 3 years after what the US goes through that everyone else goes through it. So, yep, you're probably going through it right now is the PRI movement stuff. And it's good, but there's a rabbit hole and you gotta find that rabbit hole and run from it. But I had to wrap it back around. I was like, okay, this I can't actually like convey this in a way to these like these lifters who don't understand this. So what am I going to do? And so what I did is I was like, I need to make more technique content. Cause if I make more technique content, it's going to start to hone my thoughts in. And I think it was 2022 or 2023. I was like, I'm going to make way more videos on technique. And what I started realizing is every single time I was making a video, it was coming back around to the setup. And that's when I realized, I don't think it's revolutionary, is that if you nail your setup, everything else is simpler. Because most people's faults or corrections are just trying to fix what they messed up in the setup. Like you had mentioned in some of the pre-podcast notes about like, what about if someone's having like a rounded deadlift or round back delt? That frankly, a lot of it comes down to the setup. If they set up right, it may based on their leverages, they might have a round back. I mean, you can't always fix that, but a lot of people who have a round back who shouldn't, it's because in some way their center of mass is forward and they're not getting enough of a hinge in their hips back in their initial setup. And then there's nothing you can do once they lift it. Once they lift it, they're stuck in that position to an extent. So definitely doesn't mean that I don't cue anything during the lift. It's just that I think if you nail your setup and you're very intentional there, you get everything what you need, it probably is going to give you the most bang for your buck. An example I'll use that I wrote down, maybe this is a little bit of an exaggeration, but like, the fact is the muscle is like a rubber band or something you're stretching and releasing. Like it's only going to do the result of it is how it's loaded. Like if you pull a rubber band and you release it, it's only going to go in the direction you load it. Same thing with like archery, and archery is my example I'm thinking of. If you were to shoot an arrow, you wouldn't cue the arrow to do something different in the air. Like, that would be dumb. Like, it's already shot. You're going to cue what you're doing in your setup, and you're going to cue what you're doing in the actual, like, tension pulling, which the setup is squat, bench, and deadlift setup. Like, that's it. And then the tension pulling, when you actually pull back the arrow with the bow, would be your eccentric. Once you get to the concentric, you can't do anything. You loaded the movement, and it's just the release of that loading and that stretching. And so it's kind of like looking at, like, okay, so how do we go through these steps to create that correct loading with the muscle? And again, yeah, I think if you nail your setup, so many other things fall into place, and then you can be a lot simpler with your cueing during the movement, which that's what everyone wants. They don't want to overthink while they're actually moving. It's a lot easier to overthink during the setup. And then when you're moving, let's just stick to one simple thing to kind of constrain what you're doing. So that's the biggest thing. Is almost everyone, I'm cueing during the movement, but I'm trying to find one simple thing to do. And then the setup is might where we overcomplicate the thoughts a little bit more.
Yeah, I think I can think of one or two things in the deadlift where the execution part is important, especially if you pull sumo. But I totally agree on squats. It's not about how you get out of the hole, but how you get into the hole. Oftentimes I see lifters falling over, stuff like this. It always comes down how they go down or how they prepare for the squat, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like use the squat, for example. There's probably 2 to 3 really significant things that are going to affect your descent and then therefore affect the cueing. One is your rib cage versus your pelvis position. How that is oriented during that initial setup is going to affect so much of what happens going down, positively or negatively. And that's how you have to cue based off of that. And then the next one is, where is your center of mass with your foot pressure? Is it further back on your heels? Is it further forward on your toes? That's going to affect so much. There's small little things like that that give you such a bang for your buck that if you nail that, everything else becomes simpler with it.
I don't know which case study it was. It was something about deadlift where the only cue you gave was take time on the setup, but then just execute it. And I found it fascinating that this was the only cue you gave or the only technique instruction. I think also on bench press, you just gave the drill with turning your hands inwards and leave the hand open to find a better bar path. How many cues do you usually give? Do you limit yourself so not to overload the athlete?
Yeah, I mean, I would say if we're talking during the lift, one, maybe two things that I want them thinking about, like common things on bench press would be reach the chest to stop the bar or break at the elbows. Like whatever I feel like based on what they're doing that they're going to benefit more. Are they letting the bar collapse when they come down? Okay, I want you to reach the chest up to stop the bar. Is there initial descent off? Like a lot of people on bench, they have too much horizontal movement initially, and then that creates that kind of like dumping motion with the bar, and then they're having too much horizontal motion coming back, and that's where you find those coaches yelling back, not realizing there's nothing they can do to get the bar back because the descent was off in the first place. So I'm just trying to figure out what is the cue that's going to constrain that the best. So and try and narrow that down to one thing, because I think with the setup, like I mentioned, and you were kind of saying with the let's use the deadlift for example, you've got 60 seconds to get the to break the bar off the floor. Now, I'm not recommending you take a full 60 seconds, but too many people get up to the bar and they take less than like 3 seconds to go from standing over the bar to then lifting it. But with the deadlift in particular, the eccentric action is your setup. Unlike squat and bench, where you don't have to unrack, you don't have to walk it out, you don't have to go through an eccentric action. Your eccentric action is like that wedging process. So it's very important to nail that initial setup and then eccentric kind of wedging action where you build that tension, because that's all there is. Like you're taking that out of the rift and it's a concentric only movement. So take your time on it with each step. I think it sounds like overthinking when you really take your time on the setup, but at the same time, you're just trying to break down the movements you're doing versus doing it in just one fell swoop, which unfortunately creates somewhat of an inconsistent pattern. I think that's one of the big things too, is not only it limits cueing. If you can nail your setup and you can be consistent with it, that's going to create consistency rep to rep as well and set to set. You're going to have less variability in how you're performing each movement.
That's definitely one of the biggest issues I see with athletes. I'm not going to say my athletes, but maybe that's what I mean. Is that the initial setup is, I'd say, not executed properly in the way they should definitely treat it, more like the most important thing. Everyone is just thinking about the top set, the top single, the top set reps, whatever. but like the initial setup is what you definitely set the base for. But I see so many people just, I don't want to say waste their time, but maybe you know what I mean, with the setup, and they rush the setup because of hype, because of arousal. And I think that's definitely something that everyone can learn from to just nail the setup even better.
And the cool thing with the setup is, like, there's different camps here on, is there a certain loading or percentage of 1RM you have to have that actually translates to, like, technique and skill? Some people say, like, really sub-max weights aren't going to... Your setup is the same every time. Every single rep you ever do, you're not worrying. I mean, to an extent, if you're squatting 800 pounds or 300 plus kilos, yeah, the walkout is a little different. I understand that. I can't fully relate, but I do understand that there's... But regardless, you can practice your setup every single rep and be consistent with that regardless of weight. So that's where I would say light weights can still yield great skill practice results, because you still, every single rep, every single set, get to practice that setup. And this is somewhat of opinion, but like I see so many informational posts on technique and whatnot. And I would say like half of the ones I see, I'm like, all you're doing is cueing something that, yes, it's working, but you're cueing something to fix what the person did in the setup in the first place. And if you would have just fixed their initial like rib cage orientation or center of mass or like their hip position on the deck, if you would have just fixed that, you don't need to cue what you're cueing, because you're cueing the result of it. You're not cueing the initial like thing that caused it.
I think we all know people who are doing banded deadlifts or block deadlifts to fix their lockout, but their initial setup is shit. And that's where the problem actually starts and not in the lockout itself.
Yep, for sure. I mean, something I don't know if it's how popular it is in Germany. I know it got really big in Europe, and it still kind of is the whole pre-hinge thing on squats.
It's such a big topic everywhere.
I think it's a French thing.
Okay, French really did. Well, the French, they did it in large part because of their bar position, because the lower the bar is, the more you're going to have a pre-hinge, versus like, which I have a whole, I could rant on the French squat as well. But like people who purposely are extra pre-hinging to fix something. And I'm like, that is such a band-aid, because you're causing so many other issues by doing that in the first place.
Yeah.
Things like that. I see that all the time of like, oh, you should pre-hinge and it fixes this, this, and this. It's like, if you were to just fix the root cause, you don't have to pre-hinge.
Just this month, I onboarded an athlete who has a crazy pre-hinge. Shout out to Sebastian. Hey, Sebastian. And I told him, let's do tempo squats. And the first thing we have to get rid of is his pre-hinge and start to do simultaneous knee and hip flexion. And he really struggled and said like, I did one rep without pre-hinge. This felt really weird. Then I switched back to the pre-hinge. And I told him, yeah, it's going to be hard. You have to relearn everything you did the last couple months. But I think you can't reach depth certain times if you pre-hinge too much, and it becomes a zigzag squat. So just the hip, then just the knees, then just the hips, and then at the end, just the knees again. Yeah, and I told him it would be hard, but I think we'll have a lot more progress long-term if we can relearn this.
I'll give you a simple thing for listeners and for you guys, if you haven't heard this before. The number one reason people prehinge and they see benefit is because their rib cage orientation's off, and by prehinging, it forces them to be more neutral. If you get really, really forced chest up, like prehinging, if I all of a sudden prehinge, it's going to pull me down because of gravity. Like naturally, I can't, it's going to be really hard to keep this position because it's going to feel terrible. But if I get someone to prehinge, it's going to drop them to more neutral. The opposite, if I'm really rib cage down, it's going to push my hips forward. If I tell someone to prehinge, they're going to have to extend at their low back to get more neutral to then get in a better position. So literally that prehinge is mainly just fixing the rib cage orientation and the pelvis, which they could have just fixed in the first place. Like I had someone recently message, or they posted on Instagram and they tagged me stating, kind of rebuttaling the fact of, oh, here's a lifter I have that I did a prehinge and it worked. And I messaged them. I was like, nicely, I was like, I'm glad that worked. If it keeps working, keep going with it. But I'm going to tell you right now, I went and looked at their videos. This is what they were doing wrong in the first place. And if you did this instead, it would fix it. And he's like, all right, I'll try this next block instead. I'm going to let this play out because it's going well. Then they came back to me the next block. They said, you were 100% right. After we actually fixed the root cause, like we didn't need to prehinge, and they felt so much better.
That's the problem when you try to fix the symptoms with another cue. I mean, there's where the whole chest up thing comes from videos where they did Olympic lifting advices, and then they start to cue powerlifters with, yeah, chest up, and this stuff.
Yeah. And honestly, so we actually talked about this on the I think it's the one coming out on Powerlifting Now. We talked about cues that we used to hate that we now like. We talked about you guys being like 2 or 3 years behind. Are you now in the phase of the depressed rib cage and everyone like super like hunched over with their rib cage?
I mean, Falk told us that the last step in the squat was to get back in a more neutral position and decrunch a little bit, which felt better for him.
What eventually happened from all the stuff I felt in 2020 in the US is that everyone started having these really crunched over, flexed over rib cages. And that's way worse. Like, the fact is on squat, we're fighting against flexion. We're trying to extend. Like, that's why people want to chest up, is that's the natural fight against the gravity and the forces. And then we got into this really like down rib cage position. And then I realized chest up wasn't as bad as I thought. I'd actually rather have that. If I had to choose between the two, the lesser of two evils, we went way too far the opposite way of the spectrum. I'd actually rather have your chest up because at least you're fighting against the forces that we're going against now versus like succumbing to the forces of wanting to drop it down. So yeah, there's a happy medium. Like you don't have to be perfect with your rib cage orientation, but just going on a tangent with the prehinge thing, that 9 times out of 10 is fixing a fault with the initial rib cage and pelvis orientation and center mass. And if you just fix that in the first place, you'd be great.
It's so much information that is already out there and you already discussed, but I'm just rethinking everything again now. It's actually fun, but it's also quite scary. but anyways, we've just talked a bit about top sets and top singles, and we all love our top sets and whatever they are. But of course, we've all seen athletes who get, I'd say, like overly focused on their top sets. Are there like situations where you ditch a top set completely? It doesn't have to be like top single or whatever, just a top set. Or how do you handle it when it becomes an issue for your athlete?
And maybe for our listeners, they heard it from us, but maybe you can give your view why you have such a constant top set in your programs, even in the off seasons or more like off season phases.
Okay. So first I'll start with why top sets, because we have to have an understanding there. And I might forget some of the things in my top set back down video. I think I get on Powerlifting Now, I think I gave a full thing because like I said, earlier, if I don't think of every little thing, sometimes it annoys me. But the biggest, honestly, the single biggest reason I think top sets work is because it fits into the psychology of why you powerlift. Like, we all got in here to lift a heavy set. Like, let's just be honest. Like, we didn't come in here to lift super, super lightweight. But we also know we can't lift a ton of heavy sets. We can't do that for 5, 6, like every single workout. So the top set back down approach does a good job of satisfying kind of like the psychological requirements of what powerlifters are going to be motivated to do, as well as a nice way to regulate training, because that top set, especially using some type of RPE or variable percentage where that can be adjusted on the day based off of strength, that then can downregulate all the back off work. Because in online coaching, we're in this weird position where we can't be there to adjust on the fly. So we have to build that into the program. We have to build in these safety nets of, oh, if the workout is variable, good or bad, how can this lifter then be able to adjust on the fly without me being there to instruct them directly? And so that's where I think the top set back down approach works really well, is that it helps to downregulate the back off work, and it helps to basically do what I would hopefully do in person with them. Three, I already listed two reasons. Three, I think it's a great way to be of a test marker and then be able to push and drive intensity, because we need volume, we need intensity, we need absolute load versus relative load, all that kind of stuff. I think it creates a good way to be able to manage all that within the entirety of a program, especially looking at like a primary day versus a secondary day and how we're going to be pushing different things, all that kind of stuff. So I think it just works as a good model for all of that and how we regulate training. With that said, like you said, people can get so hung up on that top set. And frankly, right now, I think it's because of the type of lifters I coach. Most of them are more mature in their training. I don't deal with a lot of people that struggle with that idea, but I definitely have. And so some thoughts here. And I actually, when I was answering this question, I came up with an idea that I'm really excited to try. And I mentioned to you guys before we started the podcast, I literally messaged Sean Noriega before this earlier today, and we started talking back and forth, because this is something we were actually talking about on the podcast that's going to be released in February, is this idea of like, should we be pulling back these top sets and driving back down work more? And we all agreed that's probably a good concept, but how do we do that? it's simple just to say do it, but like, what's the equation? Like, if we pull down top sets and we can raise back down intensity by 3%, does that equate to a similar level of fatigue? That's the issue there. Is like, if we do this, it ends up being a different model of what we find is working, and then we might go astray. Like, how are we able to do this? So, backtracking a little bit. One, do you have to do top sets? No. I mean, there's entire coaching models like TSG who rarely do top sets and they do more straight set volume. I actually, my first coach, Hanny Gesarelli, when I was with TSA way back in the day, we never did top sets until like meet time. It definitely can work. There's an aspect there. Again, it goes to lifter psychology. They like the opportunity to display that strength. I think it keeps people motivated, and there's more to it than just like the actual physiological adaptations and strength and whatnot. I think there's an aspect of also like keeping lifters in touch and giving them the ability to test things on a frequent basis, if not weekly, but each block is beneficial for them to keep them engaged. Probably my go-to is doing more of an ascending set approach, since I don't typically do straight sets, just me personally. I think ascending sets take a lot of the issues away, because one, it starts to semi pre-fatigue to an extent, not a lot, like it's not going to kill your top set, but it is going to mute it to an extent, as well as I think as lifters build up, they make better decisions. Most of the people that I think you find are really bad with top sets are these people making hero jumps to their top set, and then they don't execute well, and it's terrible. It's not the people making really good decisions and warming up very adequately that usually are making good or making bad decisions on top set approaches. So I think a lot of times you can just take those lifters and toss them into an ascending set approach, and they're probably going to make better decisions because they're going to have to do a set at 5, a set at 6 RP, a set at 7. And then by that third set, they're like, oh, okay, yeah, I can feel like the difference on the day. Maybe I shouldn't do this. Like, I can kind of tell. And so that takes care of it to an extent. With that said, though, here's my idea that I came up with that now I want to try. Because the issue with the top set is people get so attached to it. Because one, it's the performance indicator, but two, they have an attachment to the number because they know that number. They have a very distinct idea of what they should do, because with squat, bench, deadlift, we have these preconceived notions of what I've done for a triple, what I've done for a single, you know what you can do. If you get more variation, you don't know that. Like if I told you to do a high bar pause squat right now at 7 RPE, you may not know what to do, nor do you have any attachment to what that number is. And that kind of pulls you away. And so, a thing I use very, very often is like high specificity top set and then variation back down. I really enjoy that. And what clicked with me after our talk between me, Sean, Marcellus, and Matt last week, and then answering this question, I was like, what if I flip it? What if we do these periods of time away from a meet where we want to build load capacity, we want to drive average intensity, we want to take the pressure and the emphasis off that top set? What if we do a top set that is a decent self-limiting variation? Let's use squat. And we do a high bar pause squat that someone really has no idea what they should be doing on. They don't have any like preconceived notions or attachment to the numbers they're doing. It's novel, so they're probably somewhat motivated by it because it's a new interesting thing that's going to naturally progress just from skill practice and like the demands of it. And then back off the comp squat with slightly higher average intensity where we can drive that a bit more, not only because the top set is a variation that's self-limiting, but also because if it's new to them, they're going to suck at it at first in a good way. It's probably going to be decently self-limiting where that's going to lower the fatigue at the top set. That's not going to be as difficult. The stress goes down. We can then now raise by a certain percentage the back off volume. And now we can be able to basically flip the script and they get the novelty and the excitement for this top set. And then the back downs, again, I haven't tested this, but I'm just thinking about it. Like, a lot of people don't like the back downs. They don't get motivated for it. But I wonder if you go from the variation to comp squat, if you're more motivated, because now you think, oh, I did my variation thing. Now I get to do the actual work. And you never think that during back downs. You think that, oh, these are the sets I just got to get them done. So that's my thought. I want to try that out now.
Okay. So we kind of motivated you. Nice.
Yep.
Do you have something like this in your program, Kona?
Not in my program. Nor do I program it, but I remember back last year, I was doing pin bench and then doing a heavier set of comp bench after it. And I hated it so much because it felt awful because I was expecting to to touch the pins, and the pins, they weren't even super high off my chest, but I was expecting to touch the pins. I was expecting to have this kind of stability the pins gave me, even though I only like soft touched them, but it felt so freaking weird. And then we tried out doing close grip bench first to get some volume in and doing some comp bench afterwards. And that was even worse because I was like doing the, let's say mid grip, because I'm doing like the max wide grip, and I was doing pinky on the ring as the mid grip bench. So I benched mid grip and switched to the wide grip after it. And I felt like I'm going to tear my chest apart, because those extra couple of fingers out was such a weird like stimulus on the pecs, and I didn't really know how to act with it. So I just said, okay, maybe we can find something else, and I'm just not going to overshoot my top set. How about this? And we tried something else then.
So it worked.
Yeah. You might have hated it, but
it worked.
The intention worked. And to be clear, what I'm saying here, I'm not saying I came up with an idea to do a variation top set and comp squat back. That's, I'm sure people do it, but
yeah,
people do a lot of things, but for different reasons. And sometimes the reasons are new. And so the thought process here, and it worked for you, like if I gave you this pen press, you're like, this freaking sucks and I suck at it. You won't overshoot your top set because you hate it, and it self-limits you. But then you get to go back, you get to do your back downs now for comp bench, and you're like, finally, I get to do it. Like, it kind of satisfies the requirement of like, okay, maybe we need these periods away where we take away this priority of the top set. But if we keep it comp specificity, you're too attached to what you should be doing. You get too attached to it. Versus, I think the flipping the script there, I haven't tried it, but I think that might be the answer for that situation that I personally am looking for with how I do things.
Oftentimes when I have a client that comes new to me and I see they really need some technique work on their sumo deadlift, I replace the single with a pause single before they do their back downs. I already did this myself, and you really have more energy for the back off. And the other thing I can think of is days between the primary and secondary days, so the off days or the technique priming days. I got some female athletes that need a constant stimulus of singles, and I often gave them a tempo single followed by Larsen press or normal press. These are cases where I think this works pretty good.
Yep. Within this, if again, I need to experiment with it, but my thought process here, because I'm going to use the pause deadlift, because I love pause deadlifts. There's one issue with them, though. I don't think they're far enough in specificity for what I'm talking about here, because
true.
You can do a similar load and they're pretty darn close to the same movement. Here's what I'm thinking in this idea. Have them do a conventional deadlift top set because they don't conventional, and then back off to sumo work. That, like, literally
they won't overshoot because they hate conventional.
Yeah, differentiate it so much because it takes away that this performance pressure and anxiety at the top set, because now you're doing conventional and they hate it, but then they get to go back down to sumo afterwards for their back down work, but will be heavier back down work than they usually do because you're trying to drive this average intensity with these straight sets.
So would you, like, just thinking about it now, would you actually re-warm up in sumo then, or would you just say, okay, I did a top set in conventional with, I don't know, 250, and now I gotta pull, let's say, ascending sets from like 220 to 250, for example, in sumo? But do you re-warm up, or you just tell yourself, okay, I'm just gonna load 220 and straight raw dog without warm up for sumo?
It depends how heavy it is, but assuming it's some type of semi submaximal back down work, I don't think you probably have to rewarm up. Because I do that. Like I said, I'll have some people do a comp squat top set and safety bar back downs, and I'm not going to have them rewarm up on SSB. Now, maybe you do ascending back off sets because you want to create a little bit of, like, let's start a little lighter because they've got to get a little bit of skill. But I mean, I don't know if they need to rewarm up for it, because that is the issue with the variation changes, is like, how much time does it add in the gym? Like, if they got to change bars, they got to change movements, and yeah, you're telling me that they warm up again, that starts to create issues, because now their workout adds 20 more minutes because they got to re-warm up for sumo, and you know that they got to post something on Instagram in between each warm-up set, and then, yeah, that's not going to work. So, yeah, I would probably, in this instance, barring I program it too heavy, I would just have them go straight to sumo. And if I am programming it heavy enough where I'm like, eh, I don't like the idea of backing off and just like going straight to it, I'd probably program some like ascending back off sets to get to that point again.
And that's interesting. A friend of mine is actually doing this, doing a top set in low bar and then doing SSB after it. After the podcast, I'm definitely going to DM him and ask him what he is doing, because I haven't really thought about it just yet, but it kind of makes sense, because when I'm thinking I'm going straight to the SSB, at least for me, I don't know if I would like it, if I would perform the way my coach actually wants me to, but interested to see what he says.
So let's go to the next topic. I am actually really excited about your opinion. I don't know if you heard about the term. I heard it first from Juggernaut, adaptive resistance. Because you dropped recently a video on powerlifting now about novelty, talking about when it might be necessary to swap an exercise or a stimuli if the broke starts and the block isn't working anymore. But you are also known for not making these huge changes from block to block. So do you think lifters can actually build resistance to a stimulus over time? Or is there something else at play?
So my first thought is, do I think adaptive resistance exists? Yes, it probably does to some extent. But I think probably 9 times out of 10 when we see something stop working, it's probably not because we overly adapted to it, because let's be honest, we're powerlifting. We squat, we bench, we deadlift. Nothing we're doing is that far off from the core movements in the first place. So if we were adapting to that, like we shouldn't be getting stronger progressively for a long time. Now, obviously people will say, okay, well, yeah, you got squat, bench, and deadlift, but you can do programming changes and different stuff within the programming and microcycle and all that kind of stuff. But for the most part, I think, anytime someone in a sense would adapt, that is very multifactorial. Yes, maybe they actually adapt on a physiological level, but things change. People get stronger. You add 100 kilos to your total. That now changes how much you're loading on a daily basis in average intensity and volume and tonnage. You got bigger. Your leverage has now changed. You change weight classes. People have lifestyle factors that changes recovery. Some people get bored and they lose motivation. So there's a psychological component there. So I think there's so many things that go into the combination of it. Because there are some people that probably they can milk things forever. And I think you probably, if you found those people, let's say they did the same thing for 4 years and they kept getting stronger, which happens, they're probably the same people that tell you that they have no lifestyle changes. They're doing the same things every single day. They've been the same body weight. They're getting stronger, but they were already a pretty advanced trainee. Like, I think there's just so many things that probably go into it, instead of just saying blaming adaptive resistance as the reason we need to change something because the stimulus wore off. Because I think we've seen way too many times people be able to do a certain setup or certain general programming method and milk it for a very, very long time. And usually the reason it starts to not work is not because of the actual program not working. It's because of how much has changed elsewhere. I mean, probably the single biggest one I have and why programming changes need to happen is one, lifestyle factors, because this is a hobby for us and things are changing around us. We're having kids, we're getting jobs, whatever it may be. And then two, the fact of getting stronger and that now you're squatting 50 kilos more, you're benching 20 kilos more, you're deadlifting 70 kilos more. That makes way more of a difference than I think than the adaptive resistance does, because that's the big programming change. I mean, that's huge of what that then is going to adjust, because I think that's a lot of times I see a lot of people like we do less over time instead of more, because if you add this much, the same program before with now what seems like less is actually the same total tonnage or average intensity or whatever it may be because of how much you got stronger. So, with that too, I mean, so Matt Cronin is the one that made the novelty video, and I coached Matt for 2 years. And I can tell you, Matt, and one of the reasons he made that video is his issue in the sense of adapting to what happened is he would get very bored from the same things. And that's okay. that is some people happen. And so with Matt, I mean, for coaching him as long as I did, we would go 2 or 3 blocks, we'd build some momentum, and then every single time it would sputter. And Matt just did really good with novelty because it would excite him. It would give him something new, like a new variation, a new slightly different microcycle setup. He just liked the novelty of that because it created motivation and intent and focus in his workouts. So I think that, I mean, when looking at even why Matt made that video, that was a big reason because he felt that way. That happens to him. And I know it definitely happens to other people. So, and the last thing I'll say within it too, is one of the reasons not to make larger scale changes is when you develop this system or this structure for an athlete and you do it and they get stronger and it works really well. Not only is it working for them, but you start to understand so much what to expect within that structure. And so when that structure goes wrong and it doesn't work anymore, it tends to be easier to understand why it doesn't work anymore and how to adjust it from there. Versus if you're constantly saying, oh, we're going to adapt to the stimulus and you're changing things just to change things, you can't tell if it's not working because you changed things or because of whatever it may be. So that's another reason why is like even when you, let's say the adaptive resistance is a thing and you're adapting to the stimulus, running something similar without making large scale changes is going to allow you to then understand what are they actually adapting to and what is not working anymore.
Yeah, I think you are also just getting closer to your genetic potential. And your receptors are not getting less sensitive, but you are just, it's just harder to adapt to a stimulus. And often the resensitization just works because you're getting weaker again.
Mm-hmm.
I also think the stronger you get, the less you get out of one block of training. And then you will have random fluctuations from one block to the other. One block you will gain 5 kilos, and then the next, maybe you stay, and potentially the next you would regain another 5 kilo or 2.5 kilos. But you will never know because you thought, oh, okay, the program is stopping to work. We need to change something. And these are just random fluctuations if you get better.
Yep. And talking about, let's see if I can explain this right. So talking about advanced trainees, because usually when you're getting to this point that you're thinking you're adapting to something, you're usually more advanced. Like you've been not advanced, like has to be like the strongest lifts in the world, but you've been training for a while. At that point, likely, I think what the slowdown of progress tends to be a lot of times is how much can you milk the same setup and continue to grow muscle? That's something I thought about. And one issue I think with powerlifting being kind of a short-term sport, like if I knew I had someone for the next 10 years, I probably, and let's say they don't care about their performance until 10 years from now. They literally say, I don't care how I am or what I'm doing or how I'm placing. I just care in 10 years from now that I'm the best. I would probably approach it different. But the issue with powerlifting is we've got to have these people, if I'm coaching Natalie or Waskar competing at a world level, they've got to be the strongest in the world in their weight class 2 to 3 times a year. And they have to keep doing that as well as like, who knows if they're going to keep doing it for 10 years. Powerlifting is more of a hobbyist sport in general. While some people do take it serious. I mean, the fact of the matter is most, I mean, there's very few people other than maybe Agata and a couple others that are doing this as a full-time job. Like even John Hack, who I'm sure has a ton of money from sponsorships, has a full-time job. Things change. You get families, you get kids, priority. Like a lot of people don't do this for 10, 15, 20 years. But what I'm getting to is if I had someone for 10 years, I very well may take periods of changing training to overly emphasize hypertrophy. Because most of what we do is trying to combine all the modalities. We need to create neurological adaptations. We need to create physiological adaptations. We need to be able to grow muscle. We're trying to do it all at once because of how powerlifting is generally structured and being a hobbyist sport. But if I had someone for 10 years, I may approach it different knowing that like, if the best way to put on muscle is X, I need to do that. And we already know, I mean, bodybuilders don't train like powerlifters for a reason because powerlifting has inherent fatigue costs and issues with the fact that we're performing these three lifts that are not optimal for hypertrophy. And within the structure we're doing, like doing one block of hypertrophy isn't going to do anything. Doing 3 years of hypertrophy work, that might do something. And that might be what we're talking about. And then we can come back to the power lifts, have this much higher ceiling of potential for this lean muscle gain. And then that's kind of what we're getting around with the adaptive resistance. That's probably what I think we're running into more than anything is not adapting to the stimulus, but adapting to the fact that like there's only so much lean mass we can add with how we can continually train. And unless we take these prolonged breaks, how are we going to change that? A good example, I don't know if he did specialize hypertrophy work, but a good example of taking time away and coming back better was Bryce Lewis. Bryce Lewis, I forget the time period, but he kind of hit a plateau. And he took like 2 years off competing and then came back with like 50 kilos added to his total out of nowhere. And it's because he took off that pressure of like, I have to do this meet every 6 months and I can now be able to say, okay, what are the things I need to get better at? And let's do this over 2 years.
So would you say it would be sometimes better to slow down and not allow the biggest potential progress on SPD in a short time, but to focus more on long-term development and building mass, essentially?
100%. I mean, that would be optimal, but I mean, the average power lifter competes for 2 to 3 years and is done. And that's the issue with most coaching. Elite level and advanced level people competing at super high levels, maybe they do it for longer. But the fact is, the majority of people who power lift do it for 1 to 2 meets and then they're done. And so if I have them for 1 to 2 meets, how do I maximize their potential? We got to squat, bench, and deadlift. But if, like I said, if you told me I had someone for 10 years and they don't care about it until the 10-year mark, I would probably treat it differently.
Yeah, I also think that you wouldn't need so much periodization or changes in your program, but one of the biggest reasons to do it is just psychologically, to just create buy-in and get the lifter excited, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's another, I didn't bring that up, but that's another issue too, is like people want to get into powerlifting. If you told them, I'm going to make you bodybuild for the next 2 years, I don't want to bodybuild. I mean, that's literally what I want to lift heavy weights. I want to squat, bench, and a deadlift. I would, if you told me that right now, I wouldn't enjoy that. Like I like squat, benching, and deadlifting. So there's a lot of inherent issues with that. But I think that, I mean, when you're talking about adaptive resistance, I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that we get to a certain point that what we do is not adding lean tissue in an effective way to continue to get us stronger at the rate we want us to.
I'm really happy when I got athletes that be like, to be honest, I don't care what we do. I don't care if there's a block without PRs or two, or I even had three blocks without like any significant PRs. But after it, there was so many PRs coming, and it still is. And it's basically the same structure, the same layout we're doing. Then on the other hand, there's just people that like doing one block and be like, oh, can we change this and this? And this one as well. And I want to go like 5 days now, but I only want to bench 3 days. And can we do 3 squat days? You're just sitting in front of your sheet and be like, bro, like there's no way I can find any good comparison to the previous blocks when we change everything up every time. And it's hard to explain it to people, because of course you can understand that you want to have something new, something exciting, and no one really wants to do, I don't know, fours on ascending, fours on squad for the next, 6-7 blocks. But if you say to them, that's exactly what we need, that's exactly what is going to get your squad up like in 10 years from now.
People who last in powerlifting are okay with the same thing over and over.
Yeah.
Because you can't make it. We are going to inherently do the same things over and over. That's why some people only do it for a short amount of time. Like, you've got to be okay with it being somewhat boring and enjoying the process. So, as well as, I definitely have heard it from the French, but in Germany, is there any of a trend of don't do accessory work? Accessory work is pointless.
It's dropping just from France here.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Because I disagree so much. And bluntly, I think we see the issue. If you told me I need to get the strongest I physically can in 1 year, we're going to squat, bench, and deadlift, and that's probably all we're going to do. We're going to allocate every ounce of recovery to that. And that's what they did. And we see that they get super strong really quick. And then it just kind of stays. Versus if you want to get really strong over the long term, squat, bench, and deadlift probably are not the best way to do it. So supplementing with lower stress, things that don't beat you up as much, that have higher specificity for isolating muscles to grow them, probably accessory work is going to be a good option. But the issue is how do we interplay all of this? Of like, let's use these accessory work to grow while not letting it interfere too much with getting stronger on squat, bench, and deadlift. And that becomes like the semi art of programming, is how do we improve all these modalities that we're trying to improve in a singular fashion, versus a lot of other sports, like in powerlifting, there's been a lot of talk about like the periodization's overrated, which I do somewhat believe for powerlifting it is, because we don't have to periodize that much. We do the same things over and over, versus if you're I'll try and be as European as possible. If you're a football player, you have in season, you have out of season, you have different modalities you're trying to train, by the fact of like, I don't have to play two matches every single week right now, so I can be able to do a little bit more weight training. And then, but come season time or preseason, I got to get my speed training up. And then in season, it's about trying to be maintenance and not be injured. Like, it's a lot more complicated versus we're literally just training one thing over and over.
I really enjoyed your take on the programming strategies for accessory work, because I think we all know the lazy programming of a 3x12 at 8 for everything. I think pretty much everyone we talk to, and also Maxi, Falk, and me, we're very much on the do your accessories and train them as hard as possible side. And I think it's mostly actually the French people, but you also see, let's say, Pana doing accessories now. Yeah. I don't know if they did them 2 years ago or 1 year ago, but in like videos or everything, you can see them doing leg press as well now. I still think their main focus, of course, is the SPD stuff.
I'll tell you what, when we fix it, France has a pretty high participation in powerlifting, but I can see all the analytics for powerlifting now. It's one of our lowest subscribing countries, and so that's the issue.
I don't know if that's because of accessory work or if that's because of the language barrier. Let's be honest.
So, I'm going to get on a tangent because I have questions for you guys, because this is actually something we're looking into, is adding more subtitles, because we were shocked that actually the majority, I think it's like 60 to 70% of our subscribers are international, which makes sense because the information isn't as readily available. I think we have more self-coached athletes internationally because of financial reasons and not being able to afford a coach for $200 a month or whatever it may be. And we're trying to figure out which countries would be the most bang for the buck with subtitles, because the issue is like some of the countries we have, like Germany. I looked at Germany, but I was looking into it, and it seems like it's decently heavily English speaking, at least as a second language. So would that be as beneficial to even have subtitles when most countries who are German speaking also tend to have high proficiency in English, versus it did look like France and Italy specifically were lower proficiency comparatively. So if you guys have any info on that, I would be all ears of what countries in Europe that you think tend to be the ones that are probably going to be biasing towards needing subtitles.
I think definitely France and Italy, yeah.
I actually worked in voice dubbing for a long time. So in Germany, we have the biggest scene of voice actors and dubbing everything in German. So the problem is everybody's speaking English in theory or understanding English, but everything they're consuming is in German. We noticed this when we first dropped the episode with Pavel, that there in the statistics, there was a, in the first 1 minute, there was a big drop of listeners. And we just saw, there are a lot of people, if they want to listen to something, it's common for them that they listen in German. But yeah, in France, I heard this stuff from Pana and one other TSG coach from France. They told there weren't any informations in France for powerlifting available, and they didn't search around in other countries or internationally. So when she introduced like the national team with stuff like, hey, there's not just 5x5, 3x3, and then singles, there are different stuffs out there. And also Pana said he was majorly impacted by Mike Desheer, and yeah, his recent bench program also had lots of hypertrophy work in it. And it seemed to have.
Yeah, that's something we're looking into. And then we have English subtitles for our friends in the UK, since they can't speak opera English, so they can actually read it.
So. Shots fired, man. Your programs were the first one where I saw really light intensities, maybe even sub 60%, which aren't even that near to muscular failure. So we are talking about really low intensity, very far from failure, so maybe not that much of a hypertrophy stimulus. Oftentimes it's for priming days, but do you think there is still a benefit from doing very light work, not close to failure?
Yes, and I think we still don't know exactly why is the case. I've got some theories and I'll explain it. And I think, have you guys heard of data-driven strength?
Yep, sure.
Okay. They came up with maybe the best scientific theory of it. And I'll explain that if you guys haven't heard it. But I don't know if we're ever going to find out. But here's the thing. We know it works. Like, we know in some way, submaximal training can work for whatever reason it may be. I don't know if we fully understand why. Is it because we still get enough skill practice from light work? Is it for the fact of, like, I have, like, the idea of, like, when we think of squat, bench, and deadlift, they're heavy compound movements. And when we think, like, there's things that we don't realize are failing before, like, we get to 10 RPE. Like, other things are already at 10 RPE. That's why we see some, like, technique deviations as we get into these higher intensities. And we get to 6, 7, 8, 9. Like, you start to see technique, not even, I don't want to say break down, it starts to adjust because we can't the knee extensors can't handle the same loads at 4 RPE as it can at 9 RPE. So we have a little bit more of a hip shoot to translate to the posterior chain. So maybe at these submaximal lows, those muscles that can't handle and have to slightly change their force production, but like what's happening at 9 RPE are still getting the work at 4 RPE. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Like of how we're being able to handle position. Maybe that's an idea. Maybe it's the fact that like in some way the volume still equates, and I don't know what certain intensity would still equate to actual like workload, but I think the best explanation and the one I'll kind of go with is data-driven strength. Bailey came up with this idea that the actual earlier reps in a set are actually more specific to force production. Because we're always trying to move a weight as fast as we can, regardless. And obviously it's going to slow down at a certain point, but I might not explain it well. It's been a little while since I read their ideas on this, but basically it came down to the fact that if you did a 10 rep set to 10 RPE, the actual most specific reps are reps 1, 2, 3, and 4, where you're not pre-fatigued and you actually have the highest rate of force production. And that was their idea of why the submaximal work does work. Because again, it's one of those things of like, it works. We know it does. We could even go back to the West Side. West Side used dynamic effort and they thought it was for speed work, which I don't necessarily know if I fully agree with like speed work, but in some way that submaximal work for them was doing something. And we even see it like a light single to prime a day. Like you can do a super light single and all of a sudden now your next day feels great. And it probably goes a little bit back to the idea of post-activation potentiation. Have you guys heard of that?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
There's probably an aspect there of what's going on there. So there's a lot of things. I don't think I have a good answer. I have a lot of ideas of why it might work. It's more it does. And so therefore, we have to weigh this cost-benefit ratio of fatigue. Like we know that a heavier or higher exertion set has higher fatigue versus a more submaximal set has lower fatigue. Now, I'm not going to argue the submaximal set is creating as much adaptations and stress in a good way, but like if we balance the two, we seem to be able to handle a higher workload and be able to get a better net result than only going super light or only going super heavy. So
my theory on this, I mean, this comes from the velocity research that they noticed. If you have a velocity drop over the sets, the stimulus get less, actually, if you are fatigued over the sets. Mm-hmm. They showed this in the meta regression that the reps in reserve don't matter much for strength. It doesn't matter if you do 8 reps with the set or split them in 2x4, if it's the same intensity. I think that's what they actually found. It's open if it's really true or 100% true, but there's definitely a contribution from hypertrophy where you need to train close to failure, but maybe this is more suited for the accessories. But I think when we look at the stuff Andrew Lakers Perukakis did, the groups that they study, which just did singles, performed worse than the counterparts that did triples, I think, triples of 80%. It was exponentially higher when they performed these back-offs. So these back-offs resulted in more strength gain than just a single. So I think the volume you would need at different intensities to get the same stimulus is kind of an exponential relationship. At least this is my theory. So that you can't get enough volume in with super heavy work, then there's a sweet spot where you can get in just enough volume at a good intensity. But then when the intensity gets too low, you have to get so much volume in that you can't do it with increasing the rep ranges. So there's a sweet spot, I guess, and you can also separate your resources for some heavy sets, some lighter sets. I think there are different capacities. But yeah, that was always a theory I wanted to ask Zach about, or Greg Knuckles, who are into this research, what they think about it.
I mean, I think what you said there goes hand in hand with the data-driven strength guys came with, which is just going back to that. Yep. This higher velocity, higher force production is more specific at the earlier reps. And we know strength is mainly neurological. But we have a higher capacity from the physiological adaptations of muscle growth to have this higher propensity, like the bigger the muscle, the more force production or whatever the muscle can create. So yeah, I think that like you said, I'm not saying we don't do heavy stuff, but there's this weird happy medium of risk reward and where can we get this in? If we only go heavy, we're not gonna be able to get enough of workload in or skill practice, but we can be able to get that in a more efficient manner at lighter loads. And then, yeah, I definitely agree with hypertrophy. I think that needs to be taken closer to failure. I think we've seen that. Totally. I don't think you've seen any top level bodybuilder training like a pansy and not lifting heavy, like pushing stuff. I think it relates back because from the research you're talking about versus what the data-driven shape guy's talking about, I think is very, very similar in just like what we're trying to do neurologically from force production. And once we start fatiguing those muscle fibers a lot through a rep set or like through multiple reps and starting to be at higher RPEs, it's not actual like the same level of like the force production that's specific, as well as the fact of like, okay, well, you say, okay, well, then I can just do a heavy single. That's one rep. I'm not pre-fatiguing. Well, then it has inherently high fatigue cost comparatively doing a 5 RPE single. So is it more beneficial to do 6 5 RPE singles or 1 10 RPE single? And yeah, I don't know. I don't know if we'll ever fully find the answer because it's not like science's big priority is powerlifting research. But I think that what you said and what data-driven strength said is probably the best working knowledge we have of why that submaximal work still neurologically is creating the adaptations we want to.
I think it comes down to what you said, that you can be right for the wrong reasons. Yep. And in the end, everybody is so different and we have to find the exact solution for them. So we have to experiment anyway and see what works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could be completely wrong about something that's working well, but as long as you have a reasoning for it that guides it in a good manner, who cares? I mean, that's in my opinion, that's Louis Simmons in a nutshell. He was doing the right things for the wrong reasons, but it made sense to the point that it works super, super well. I'm sure there are tons of stuff I'm doing that I'm doing right for the wrong reasons. I thought about that on multiple things. We actually just recently had a podcast on that. But if you have somewhat of a reasoning why, it helps to guide the thinking. So, we know submaximal work works. We have ideas of maybe why. We might be wrong about it, but yeah. I mean, usually science is just either confirming or denying what we know works. We just don't know why it works.
So I promised Falk not to get too deep into the weeds and don't overdo it with nerd stuff. So that was my part of the interview. I kind of guess Kona can do the last question.
Very easy last question for you. Are you excited about coming to Germany? Have you ever been to Germany before?
Yeah, I've never been. Taylor Swift concert. Or was it just your wife?
No, just my wife.
She didn't took you with her.
No, I that was not worth the money for me. I do not need to pay that much money to go see Taylor Swift. No, she went with her friend. They can enjoy it. Let me do a guy's trip next time. Me and my wife go on enough fun vacations. She can do Taylor Swift alone. So I am excited, but should I be excited to go to Chemnitz? Is that something I should be excited about? Because
absolutely not.
Straight up. I've said it. Like, I'm going to Sheffield in next week. I'm not excited to go to Sheffield. I'm excited to go to the event, but Sheffield is not fun to go to. I remember I went to London last year, and when I was telling like people, like, oh, what are you doing else? They're like, oh, we're going to Sheffield in a couple of days. Like, why are you going to Sheffield? I feel like Chemnitz is probably the same thing, where if I go to Berlin, they're like, oh, where are you going next? I'm going to say Chemnitz. They're like, why are you going to Chemnitz?
The thing is, I lived there for my bachelor's degree from 2019 to 2021. And I have no idea why Worlds is in Chemnitz. It just makes no sense at all, for me at least.
It follows the pattern. They never pick anywhere that makes sense.
Yeah,
exactly. Even like last year they said it was in Vilnius, Lithuania. It was not in Vilnius. It was like 2 hours away in some random city that had no gyms. Waskar, yeah. I don't know if you guys, the story, Waskar, we could not find him a gym. And so he had to stay in Vilnius and he found this strongman competitor with a private home gym and got his last workout there before taking a 2 hour train or whatever to wherever the actual meet was.
Like, prepare, it's ridiculous. For pretty much the same here.
Yeah.
So but we will invite you to a gym in Leipzig, which is just around the corner, like 40 minutes.
Yeah, it's only 40 minutes
you can get.
Do you have good beer in Chemnitz? Can I at least get some good German beer?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I'll be fine then. If I can get some good lagers, I'll be good. No?
Oh, yeah. I will get you some good beer.
The thing is, I'm very biased because I'm actually not living in Germany anymore. I'm in Austria now. And
they got better beer? Yeah.
No, definitely not. This is bullshit.
Okay. Anyways.
You heard it here first.
Anyway.
Pavel said Agata gets drunk like two times a year. So I already told him, okay, this will be in Chemnitz, and then we can meet at a pub. That would be my dream powerlifting combi.
Perfect. Yourself, any Germans that want to take me to a pub, if I should be there. I assume the only reason I wouldn't be there is if the IPF makes some new rule. I will never put that against them if they make a new rule against me. But if I am there, 100%, anyone that wants to treat me to a pub and show me where the good beer is, I am down.
All right. We're going to get that done. Well, Steve, thank you very much for being our guest today. It was a pleasure. It was like meeting one of your heroes, not gonna lie. And
well, thank you. I'm not that cool. I'm just a normal dude, but I appreciate that.
You should have Kona seen before the call.
Yeah, we were all hyped. Fuck is pretty sad that he couldn't participate, but I think he's got quite a fun time listening to it. Yeah, shout out to Powerlifting Now. Who's not subscribed yet, go do it. Get yourself some informational content. And thank you for listening to today's episode. Hear us next week for the next episode. Thank you again. I will give the last words to you and enjoy.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me on. I love it because usually I'm hosting podcasts, so you guys giving me the opportunity to just talk. I'm really good at talking, probably too much, and just rambling. So really appreciate that. Like you said, I mean, I don't really have anything to promote other than Powerlifting Now. I mean, I'm biased in saying it, but also I feel like I'm unbiased because I watch every single video. I really think it's a fantastic platform, and we price it very, very cheap. Comparatively to some other platforms purposely, because we want the information out there. We want, no matter what country you're in, to hopefully be able to afford it and everything. So we hope people buy and benefit from it, because it really is just to hopefully make sure that people that come after us coaching are better than us. They give you a head start and everything. So
thank you, Steve. Goodbye.
Welcome. Bye.